When I look outward into the world, I feel very protective of all sentient beings. Everybody that is alive, especially Oliver, and my cats, and my family, my satsang family. I feel very protective of all of you, like I want to wrap my arms around you all and hold you safe. If I had children, they'd never leave the house till they were 30. But I have all these bhaktis coming to the satsang and writing me, sending emails and comments and so forth. So what do I do? You know, love to me typically has always been very painful. It's you get strong feelings, you get strongly attached, and then inevitably there's a separation, whether it's death or breakup or the ending of a relationship and the ending of the love relationship. And it just tears your heart out, and you're always fantasizing and thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I used to live in Santa Monica, and one day I was on my porch. I love cats. And I was looking into the street, and I saw a little brown tail moving behind the curb. The curb is over here, and I'm over there where Charlie is. It's a little like a periscope, a little brown tail moving. And being as smart as I am, I knew it was a cat's tail. So, loving cats and seeing a poor cat in the street, and I hate seeing cats out in the street, I called out. I said, hey, you. And the tail stopped. And then a little brown cat with these huge eyes and this big face and a wide, wide face like a Persian but with short hair looked over the top, put her paws on the curb, and just looked at me. Just 30 seconds. And I looked at her. And then she jumped up and ran over as quickly as she could with her short little feet. She had very short legs. And I petted her. She looked like she was starving. Her coat was all ragged, but she was beautiful. She was a tortie, multicolored, brown, black, orange, all mixed together. And I fed her. I went into the house and got two cans of food and fed her. And for some reason, I didn't want to take her in that day. I didn't even want to pick her up. There was something about a fierceness of her face that a little bit scared me. But I figured if she were here tomorrow in the morning when I come out, she's mine. We won't worry about where she came from because obviously she's been on the street for a while. And she was there the next day. Her name was, I called her Satchitananda. Existence, knowledge, bliss. I loved her very much. She was about 6.5 pounds. And she came into a house filled with 8 or 9 cats, and she took over. Anytime two cats even dared to make a sound at each other, like a beginning of a fight, wherever she was in the house, she'd run and get right between them and say, stop that! Just look at them like that. And they'd walk away as if nothing happened. The rest of the time, she was on my lap. And any of you who own cats or dogs, you know, a cat, if you're bonded to them, whenever you look around, they're looking at you. You look over there, and there she would be in the background looking at you, me. And I'd look at her, make sure, where's Sachi? And we were inseparable. And she thrived for a while. Sachi had a condition, unfortunately, you get it, it's common on the street, called megacolon. It's when a cat does not eat regularly, and then it eats a lot, it distorts the intestine and it blows out the colon. And they can become constipated and die easily because nothing moves through the system. And we had came to close to death with her two or three times. Unfortunately, the treatment for megacolon is hard on the kidneys. So eventually she developed kidney failure. And she was eating less and less, and we took her to the doctors, and there's more and more things you can do with the cats with kidney failure. You give fluids under the skin. There's Azadil, which causes a kind of dialysis in the intestines. There's aluminum hydroxide, which takes the phosphorus out of the blood. Pepcid to keep the acid down so that they eat. Then you can give them pills to make them feel hungry. And there's dozens of things. Force feed them with a syringe. And I was spending hours and hours every day with my little Sachi trying to keep her alive. And at night, she and my wife and I would go out for walks. She'd walk between us. No collar. Just around the block. Our last few days together. Then one day, I saw her. She was in a cupboard, and she refused to come out. Her eyes were open like this, and they were bulging. She didn't want to move. I knew it was time, so we took her to the vets, and they got some blood tests, and she was dying. We could have put her in there for another four days of dialysis, but she probably even died during the process. So we had to put her asleep. The vet was Ken Jones. He's in Santa Monica's great vet. And he did it so gently, it's like she didn't even notice it. She just relaxed. And she died. And we cried a long time. And she's up there now. She's in the top box. But at about the same time, Robert died. And this was about a year and a half after my awakening. And I saw that the world was not real. So I had three disasters. My Sachi died, my Robert died, and the world was empty. And after that, I couldn't feel love anymore. I went into a great depression for a couple of years. Loss of Sachi and Robert. That's what love did to me. Fuck this. And they had a medication, they had a program at UCLA with different kinds of medications for depression. I got into it, and after about two or three weeks or 4 weeks, the depression went away, which I know shows that there's a huge physical aspect to depression. It's a physiological kind of disorder. It's not that, you know, I know this one psychiatrist who said, I wish I could go back to all of my depressed patients over the years who I tried to talk out of their depression, when a pill could do so much better and so much more quickly. And talk therapy really is not too effective alone in depression. Medication is much more effective, as I know, because I mean, this is my business, is psychotherapy. But I didn't feel love for a long, long time until all of you bhaktis out there were telling me that they felt it coming from me. And I didn't feel it. I did notice that my teachings were changing. I wasn't talking so much about the illusory nature of the world. I wasn't talking about escaping. I was talking about how you needed to do things for other people. You had to take care of the hungry cats in the streets. Take care of poor people, or bitch about the Japanese whaling or killing dolphins or something like that. Got very active. But I didn't feel anything. I mean, I was acting it out, but I was hearing from it, from you and from others. And a few months ago, I began feeling it. I really do love. And it was buried in that sense of quietness. It was the movement of love was in that quietness, and it was coming out. Sometimes I can even feel as if it were coming out and flowing everywhere, but that's just fantasy. So many people believe, or I've heard this, people tell me, like, I'm doing something to them and having love come out, and it's generating love inside of them, as if I'm doing it. And I say, I didn't do it. Don't blame me. Because if you get angry, then you'll blame me for that too. I feel there's, you know, this thing about projecting love into each other and so forth, that's nonsense. You could react to my love, and I can react to your love, but it's our own feelings that we're feeling. There's no kind of telepathic connection. There's no kind of mystical connection. This is so easy to believe. In Eastern spirituality, you have all of these stupid concepts. All is one. What the hell does that mean? You know, we're all one. We share everything. Everything is equal. That's nonsense. Because I'm obviously here, Karen, and you're obviously there, right? You're not seeing through my eyes. You're not thinking with my brain. You're not talking with my mouth. So what does it mean to be all is one? And over again, Facebook is filled with all of these gurus that spend all these times generating one-liners about oneness or love or something like that. And there's more gurus on Facebook than there are people in Los Angeles. And they are all followers of the Neo-Advaita point of view. It's all one, and it's all happy, all blissful, and all that. And then they go off and have their popsicle and really don't care about anybody except themselves. I recognize now that the love is there, and I hadn't recognized it before. But I also want you to recognize that you're not feeling my love directly. You're responding to the way I'm talking and the way I'm responding to you. I'm not projecting love into you. I hope you know that. And I'm not catching any of yours either. Just kidding. Not a little joke. One thing about Saatchi I realized after she died. When she was very ill, I said to myself, my love for Saatchi is so strong, I'm going to save her just by the purity and the depth of my love for her. Didn't work out. No matter how much I loved her, and I loved her so much, she died. I failed. Consciousness has rules. There's medicine as part of that rule. Eastern medicine, Western medicine. Education, having knowledge about diseases, having knowledge about how to help people, how to help homeless cats. And in the real world that we live in, and it's not really real. I mean, once you have a realization about reality, you know it's not real, but at the same time you re-enter it as if it's real, and you act in this venue as if it's real. Otherwise, the realization that a person has is kind of pointless and empty to me. Unless you can take that realization back to where people really live, it's useless and dry. So consciousness has rules, and you have to know these rules in order to help. I heard something like, just recently, 37% of the people in Los Angeles are hungry at some time or other. I mean, not because they temporarily ran out of cash, but they don't have enough food in the house. 37% in Los Angeles. And there's almost 2 million homeless cats on the street of Los Angeles, the city and the county, all of the 4,000 square miles, the various cities. And 80,000 cats and dogs are put to death in public shelters every year from lack of adoptions and the being out in the street and a lack of space in the shelters. And to me, this is so incredible. This world is so cruel that we can't find room for cats and dogs in our houses or a place for them to live. So love to be effective can't just be love. It has to know the rules. And with 2 million cats and dogs, there has to be education. You have to reach people, come to the shelters and adopt. You have to talk to the governments that to put more money in the shelters. It takes wealth, it takes commitment, and you have to know the rules, which means education, science, and you can't blow it all off. And you can't just say Eastern spirituality is the way it is, or the Eastern healing arts and so forth. It has to be investigated, and you have to know what works. Well, you know, you're a healer. You're a healer. Are you any good?
She's really good.
I don't do it.
I know what you mean. Okay, all right. Why are you turning red? But there's something else going on. I feel it, but I can't put my finger on it. There's something about this satsang. There's something going on here. It's bigger than me. It's bigger than any of you. But it's a kind of turning in consciousness in a positive fashion around this satsang. It's grown very quickly from, what, this is our second satsang? I mean, we've done the worldwide ones where it was all over the world. We have people from Germany and so forth. But the local one, I feel it. I feel that there's a beneficial kind of energy. Consciousness likes what we're doing. And I take a look at it. It's like, for me, consciousness is a harsh mistress, very harsh. And what we are is a kind of mollifying force, a kind of force to make consciousness a little less harsh and a little more sweet. That's our function. We're like the conscience of consciousness. And it needs a conscience because it's not too good at it by itself. And where this is going to go, I have no idea. I don't think anybody does. Or whether it's going to blow out in a minute. Consciousness might decide, well, that didn't work, did it? And go its own way, whatever way it is. But I think that's our function, to make a world a little kinder, a little more knowledgeable, learn the rules, apply them, and see whether consciousness continues to go our way. Now, I made some comments. I made a what do you call it, on the blog about 2 weeks ago after the tsunami that got me into a lot of trouble. And I said in the comment, why don't we try an experiment with a little country where people were vegetarians and they cared for each other? And rather than trying to run from the responsibility of paying for Medicare and Medi-Cal and Social Security, they wanted to give. They wanted to help each other. And then I said something to the effect, if we had a country like this, would they have a lot of natural disasters like is all over the world? Or is there a moral causality somehow, like the theory of karma, what goes around comes around? If a people is kind and gentle and caring, would that country be less subject to natural disasters than Japan or the United States? Because who are some of the worst countries in the world so far as cruelty is concerned? United States, China, and then everybody else. And what countries have the most natural disasters? The United States, China, and then everybody else. Turkey and so forth. And so I began getting these huge negative comments, outrage that I should take this disaster in Japan and blame them for, you know, causing their own problems. And that's not what I meant, because I mentioned the United States, I mentioned China, I mentioned all of these other places that have had these natural disasters, but we have natural disasters all the time. tornadoes, hurricanes, New Orleans, earthquakes, the Northridge earthquake, the San Francisco earthquake. We get them all, big fires, bombs, people killing each other, mass killers, you know, shooting people. I mean, we're a country of disasters, a constant rolling disaster. So what was so bad about suggesting that there might be a moral causality? And not a lot of people were buying it, but a few of the Buddhists were saying something like this. And then the ex-premier of Japan said the tsunami was a punishment for the Japanese being so arrogant. And he mentioned about how they felt more superior to the other races. So it was an idea that was out there. Personally, I felt that if the tsunami hit, it was like as a retribution for the Japanese whaling, the killing of 40,000 dolphins in the cove, and fishing the oceans dry, which they overfished the oceans. And I'd say, well, if I were God, how would I teach Japan a lesson? Well, since they were destroying so much the sea, I thought, well, maybe the sea could get back at them. This is kind of my loose moralistic thinking. I mean, the United States gets it back. It gets an earthquake here, and Sodom is destroyed there, Gomorrah someplace else, you know. But it never hits the people that actually caused it. But you got to realize it's all one. We're all one. And even though you didn't cause it, if you're not stopping it, you're in a sense, you're complicit. And I saw a headline today from Japan. The tsunami wiped out the Japanese whaling industry. The big, businesses that were supporting the whaling were destroyed by the tsunami. And to me, that's, wow, check one for an objective verification of this fantasy I have of moral causation. And then a Buddhist priest today said, God sees the way the world is, how we treat each other, how we spend money in the wrong ways, we spend our wealth in the wrong ways, we let people starve. And he says, just no more, no more. Now, this is a metaphor, you know, this is a fantasy. But it could be a lesson that we should learn about how to treat others. Our little group, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know which way it's going. It'd be interesting to watch. Matter of fact, this whole topic came up in a conversation in a Thai restaurant on Pacific Coast Highway with Sam and what's her name? Andrea. I'm just kidding. And Carrie the other day. And I've been thinking about it for a week. And I've been trying to generate a talk. But, this area of bhakti and all of this, I don't know that much. I'm a dried up yoni guru. This love stuff is new to me. And so you got to teach me. I'm learning this from you guys. And I can teach you the dried up stuff, no problem. But the wetter stuff, it's new to me.
That place of peace that you speak where you dwell. The love on this, on the other side of that, is full of conditions, and I love you if.
Right.
From there, it would almost seem like there is not that kind of love present, but that's where true love arises and can come from. It comes from almost that unmanifest place. So it would seem, seemingly so, like there's not love there because it's not conditioned on the love that most people
right.
have an understanding of.
For me, at that deepest level, it's deeper than any feelings of love. Yeah. Because there's nothing that exists on that level. You're into, a pure spiritual existence where the mind doesn't exist, feelings don't exist, objects don't exist, no other exists, no self exists, no I exist. It's just pure consciousness. But on a higher level, that's when you begin feeling love, because there has to be somebody to love and somebody loving. Right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I'm talking about when you're in the other, like, oh, I see her as separate from me, so I love her. There can be conditions of I love you because you do this for me, or but then you think
that's even higher.
Yeah, yeah, and then you have love that is surpassing, like people have love for animals that are unconditional, and so they don't have that. And then the love where there is almost seemingly no love, but it's where the love, true love is, because it just is without...
Okay, if you could say that it's coextensive with that deepest level of pure consciousness. But I don't feel that in me, I don't feel that kind of, any kind of love. What I feel is peace. I feel happiness. And just on top of that is this kind of covering or a blanket of warmth, which I think may be the source of love. But it's still the purest state. There's nothing. You just are. It's hard to put it in words. But one inch above that is, I think, the most basic kind of pure love, the warmth, where you just want to hold the entire universe and care for the entire universe, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a bhakti guru. I don't know about Shaktipat and all that shit. I'm sure that people... Well, first of all, you've got all kinds of things. You've got erotic love up here. You've got where you identify with the body, and there's all kinds of body things going on, yearning and lust and so forth. And then there's the kind of love that we have that permeates most relationships, which is based on we know each other, we expect each other to do certain things, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a kind of familiarity with that. This is like an old glove, and I prefer this rather than going out and shopping for a new glove, the kind of sense of comfort. But the deeper you go, the love is more universal, it's more general, it's more gentle, and then... It disappears altogether. The deepest level, it disappears. What is curious to me is what some of you feel as love coming from me. What did I do to deserve it? I didn't do anything.
But Eddie, for some of us, like for me in particular, I changed a lot. So you can't say you haven't done anything. Because I changed a lot from the time that I started to... be your student.
You've taught us a great deal, so you've done that.
Yes. Yeah, and you're always there, even though I don't talk to you a lot. It's like you're there. If I ask you a question, I may or may not get an answer, but you
But you know, at one point I intended to give you an answer.
But
even
you're
if it...
there, like, unconditionally. From what I feel and see.
And what does that make you feel?
What's that make me feel? Makes me feel love and compassion for you. Mm. It's like a, you know, I want to give it back to you. Mm. And others.
So and what do you want to give back?
The same thing, what I learned from you, I want to give to others who are willing. So you gave me and us all of these teachings, and it's unconditionally, and I see that as money. All these gurus, like you've talked about, they all want money. The one gal up north that you were talking about, she wanted all this money, and you give to us so freely.
Do you clean garages?
Do I clean garages?
I've heard of Seva.
I really can understand what Keith said, because I feel that way. I've transformed so much in such a short time, and I get drenched with the things that you teach, and many things are very unspoken, and I feel this huge need to give back. I want to give back in the ways that I can, because all of us have different gifts in what we can give back into the world, and I want to give back. It's like a pressure. I have such purpose to give back. Mm.
Do you do garages?
I already told you, if I could wear gloves, I'll show up.
But what do you feel besides that, the pressure to give back? What is there anything else to this love?
It's huge. It's not personal. I said to you the other day on the phone that, because my purpose came when I just was born. Like, I felt that as a baby, like, this huge purpose, but I didn't know what it was going to be. And my feelings, there's two things. I told you, I have my personal love for you as my dear friend, but then I have an impersonal love for you as my teacher. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful. I mean, I can't articulate what that is, because I can touch it. I feel it.
What does it feel like?
Me.
Explain it.
It's the most beautiful, blissful, delicious feeling I've ever felt in my life. Mm. It's so pure. Mm. It expects nothing and just wants to give.
Okay. All right. Okay. I understand that 100%.
And it has... And it feels, it fulfills itself by giving. It's like it needs nothing also. Just the need to give. Because I feel full.
Hmm. And you feel that now too, to the world more?
Beyond. Hmm. Since I became your student, the things that I'm learning. But I don't say that putting you on a pedestal. I'm just saying... These are the things that changed with inside of my being. Mm.
God, I have to give you an A for that answer.
How did you feel about your teacher? What did you feel from him?
Oh, Robert, awe. He was awesome. I've studied with maybe closely 10 or 15 teachers, and I've known another 30 teachers besides that. I mean, famous people, from Zen masters to swamis and so forth, for many, 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 many years. And Zen masters all over the world. But Robert was so different. Robert was, he wasn't there. And all the other ones were very busy and very there. They were creating a big center. They were doing this. They were having sashins and all that. And Robert wasn't there. He was always in the background and just paying, you know, being himself. Everybody ignored him. If there was a satsang like this, everybody would be talking to each other and they'd all ignore him. He'd be up there eating the food from it. And it was very strange. And he would start satsang by looking around at the people while they're still meditating, and then he'd say something. And he'd look at people, and it looked so deep into your soul. And it wasn't like I look, because I'm superficial. And he wasn't. His eyes had such depth. You knew that he was seeing into the bottom of your heart, and it was sort of scary at sometimes, too. And he never blinked. He could have his eyes open for 5 minutes, and he'd never blink. It's just eyes, like, fixed. And this is one of the states of samadhi. This is one of the signs of sahaja and of some of the other samadhis. He was always in a different world. I could sense it, and I just wanted, what the hell is it that this is? This is what I was looking for. I've been with 30 teachers over 30 years, and he was living proof that there was something beyond what all of these other teachers taught. And he was a hard guy to be around because he liked to play practical jokes on people. He liked to roast them, put them in conflict situations with each other, and then just sort of... He always had this little grin on his face when things were exploding in the background. And one time we were at Follow Your Heart, and it was just before he was moving north, or to Sedona, and he seemed very pensive, even more quiet than normal. And I said, "Robert, what are you thinking about?" And he said, "On how to cook you." Every moment of the day, he was working on us in little ways, not only expressing, which he didn't express very well, anything he felt, but his teachings, but just by creating situations around us where we'd grow up. And when I heard that, you know, he wasn't having lunch with me. He was working on me. And I just saw him. But he was an imp. I mean, it was really hateful asshole sometimes, the kind of stuff he'd do. And you never knew what was going on in satsang because there were all these women around him all the time, and they're hanging on to him and clinging, and there's always gossiping about what's going on with her and what's going on. And then Nicole, his wife, would always be calling me up saying, "What's going on with this woman? What's going on with this woman? What about this guy here? I see his checks and the donation, but what's he like?" And Nicole was always calling me about everybody at satsang. Now she's my greatest enemy. She says I never existed. But that's what I felt about Robert, is just awe. I want that, whatever it is. Turned out to be Parkinson's. Just kidding.
So you were awake when you awoke while he was still alive?
Yeah. It happened about a month or two after he left to Sedona. I wanted to go. I was instrumental in him wanting to go to Sedona. One time, a lot of people from Sedona were coming to our satsang in Los Angeles. We were having 50 people come. And I love Sedona. I've been there many times. It's a beautiful place. And Robert was always joking about there's going to be a huge earthquake in Los Angeles. We got to move. So one time it's going to be Salt Lake. We're going to go to Salt Lake City, and then we're going to go to New Mexico. And I said, "Robert, why don't we check out Sedona?" And so he sent me up there as an emissary to check out the place. So, and I thought I'd loved it, and made arrangements to have everybody move up there, and even a place to have my cats taken care of, where I'd have a house where I could bring the cats up. But every time I try to go to Sedona with him, I'd get deathly ill. I mean, really deathly ill, and it happened 3 times in a row. So I knew I wasn't going to move there. Something was happening to prevent me from going. So he moved up there, and some people from Los Angeles moved with him, and I didn't. And I felt terrible. I felt that what I was talking about with Sachi, but this is before she died. And I lost my place. It was so terrifying. No. I just hung around the house. I was feeling sort of depressed, listening to spiritual music, lying on the couch, and just going inside, going into those deepest levels, just all day long, 24 hours. I wasn't working at the time. I couldn't work. I couldn't possibly work with this. And then I wrote about what happened with the shower. I went into a shower, and like a million times before, looked inside of myself to find out who was experiencing the water in the shower, and I found nobody there. The house was empty. There never had been anybody there. And when you realize that the I is not real, our entire reality is based on the dichotomy, the dualism of I and thou. When you see that the word I has no internal referent, the realization comes immediately that no external concept has an external referent. The world is not real. The world isn't real because of some magic. It's not real because I'm not real. And that's complete freedom. At least the first stage is when you see you don't exist. You're not real. And But still, I got depressed later when Saatchi died because there was still part of me that was connected with people in the relative realm, and now I'm reconnecting in that relative realm. And there is sadness with that, with the love that ends when somebody you really love dies, like Saatchi. But it's not a bitter kind of love like it used to, a bitter kind of depression or anger. It's just, it's much gentler now. Much, much, much gentler. I've had so many cats die since Saatchi died, and it's relatively easy now. It's, they're in pain, they're suffering, let them go. They hold on to me as long as possible, they want to be with me. I hold on to them as long as possible. But at some point, you realize the body is dying and they have to go. It's still not easy, but it's a lot easier. And Robert was the same way. I didn't feel much when he died because we had been separated for a couple of years. And I had visited him up there in Sedona a couple of times, and he still wanted me to come up there. But Robert wasn't human. So it wasn't like losing a person or an animal. He was God. He couldn't be lost. He wasn't a thing. He wasn't an object.
How did you get to know or find out about Robert? That through someone else?
It was, yeah, somebody said I had a friend of mine. You know, when you hang around in spirituality for 30 years or so, you know everybody. And so one of the people said, you ought to look up Robert. And I hadn't been interested in spirituality for several years, but I just decided to see. And it turned out to be this guy with the gray hair and the gray beard in Beverly Hills. And there were maybe five people in there. And I listened to him, and I saw him. And I knew he was my teacher right away. And afterwards, I went up to him, and I said, Robert, where have you been my entire life? And rather than saying, oh, I've been waiting for you, he said, I've been around. Kind of crappy answer. How can you write a book about a crappy answer like that? Now, we tried advertising. We tried every conceivable thing, and nobody came to a satsang. If people would come, they drift through, they come two or three times, and then they drift out. Because Robert was really not so much if you weren't into somebody that's extraordinary. I mean, he had Parkinson's, he had bad teeth, he even smelled a little, and that's probably because of his teeth. And he was talking about stuff nobody understood. He'd say, you don't exist, you never did, you're good for nothing. And people in the background laughed, and they didn't get it, but they'd laugh because it sounded funny and spiritual at the same time. Not many people stayed. And he'd deliberately do things to make people leave, like fooling around with the people in the satsang to cook them. And he said, I want to see who'd stay. I want to see who stays. And I think only three of us stayed the entire time he was in Los Angeles. Mary, Lee, and myself. Look what happened to us. Well, shall we sit? Okay. Turn your vision around and look inside yourself. Not into the head, but deeper. Look deeper, look deeper. Look into your heart area. Feel the sense of presence. Feel that basic amalgam of your existence. And let the consciousness go down, your awareness go down deeper. Go down into your stomach and your abdomen. Then ask yourself, what inside there is really me? What in this emptiness is really me? sometimes you have to struggle for years to find that inner emptiness because your mind is thinking too much, or there are too many images, or all you see is darkness. But with practice, it comes. Your inner world lights up, becomes very light, not dense. It's self-illumined. It extends everywhere. It interpenetrates all objects, internal and external. All thoughts are absorbed by the emptiness. All objects outside are absorbed by emptiness. My voice is absorbed by your emptiness. And you just learn to sit in that emptiness. Let your attention continue to go down, down through the floor, into the earth. I'm assuming that none of you have gone really deep, so I'll lead you through the whole process. For me, when I first started internalization, being an intellectual goofball, I looked inside the third eye. What happened to me was my mind, my head, started to feel like it was freezing, like it was becoming a rock, it was becoming dense, and the thoughts stopped moving altogether, and my head was denser and denser, and it felt like I was going to go to sleep.
He was talking about there's no choice. Is it just seems like there's choice. There's no choice.
That is a typical Indian concept. And it's there for a reason. One of the reasons is, in a societal sense, it was a concept used to quell the masses. It's like, no matter what you do, you can't escape your destiny now, so don't fight it. Don't take up arms against the government. Don't bitch and moan. Just do your job and shut up. That's on the level of control. But Robert and Ramana also said the same thing. Everything is preordained. That no matter what is happening, it was ordained before you were ever born. So, and then Robert would say, your only freedom is to turn within. And by turning within, to going to those deeper layers of yourself, where your true self lies, the witness, and thereby escape the world. That's your only freedom. But again, I think that is used just as a teaching device. It's one of those concepts. That's a real teaching concept. In other words, don't worry about the world. Just go within. And I think most of you see this world as full of shit. It's bullshit the way the world is run. Right? Don't you see it? There's good stuff. Does it counterbalance the 10 billion animals that are killed every year for food in the United States, or the 80,000 cats and dogs that are killed? Now, I don't, you know, people say, you tell them about the suffering, and they say, oh, yeah, there's the suffering in the world, but there's also beauty. Does the beauty that you see when you go to a park and see the birds outbalance all the horror that's going on? All the people that are dying constantly from all these different diseases and from wars and being electrocuted, and they shoot each other, and drive-by shootings and earthquakes. It's a massacre, constant massacre. How can you be comfortable with that?
But the only positive thing, I can go within and change myself, and then that bring more.
Well, you can't really change yourself.
Really,
you can observe yourself.
Observe myself.
And through that observation.
Through that, yeah.
There is a change for the better. But that's it. There's nothing good in the world. You have to go inside and do a metamorphosis through self-observation, self-inquiry, abiding in the self. And not everybody does it. Only people with a spiritual bent do that. The others are rushing around making movies. Doing post-production. Busy, 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 busy. Like I said in the talk, there are steps and there are processes and there are rules. But it seems that around satsangs like ours, there's more than that just happening. It's like, and I mentioned this in other places, we are teaching consciousness to be less harsh. just because of our goodness, our kindness, our mercy, we're showing consciousness a way that it can follow. We're teaching consciousness to be more mellow and more kind. But yeah, I think there's more going on here than just what we can do individually. There's a group process here, and I do think consciousness maybe take care of us better than otherwise, as long as it's happy with what we're doing. Consciousness is very fickle. It could crush us all next week and say, that experiment's over, that didn't work. And I can't really even choose to think that it is working. It's just a maybe. Maybe. We just have to watch the process around here, around us, to see if it's working. I know I get emails that these satsangs that we've posted in the videos have had profound effects on people all over the world. I mean, really, really profound awakening experiences. Four people have awakened and are teaching now. Rajiv is one of them. I forget the names of the others, because once they awaken, they go away. They don't continue to contact. They've seen through it all. They haven't come back yet. Well, they've seen through me. They see what a shallow fuck I am. They say, I don't want to have anything to do with him. No, it's all over for them. It's the Arhat ideal. Now, let me tell you something about that. Robert, in lots of ways, was a cold fish. His idea was, you win liberation for yourself. And just being liberated did more good for mankind than if somebody turns around and helps other people. In other words, he denigrated saints as opposed to the supposed yanis that have enlightenment experiences and go free. This is what the early Buddhists were. It's called the Arhat ideal, which is of self-liberation. However, about 1,000 years later, about 800 or 900 A.D., Buddhism became impacted by the Tantra from the north, love doctrines from the love aspects of yoga, and also there was another influence on it, not from Advaita, but from some other sources, and it began softening up. And it developed a new ideal. The ideal was that of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva vowed to help every other person escape suffering and distress before he or she entered liberation. In other words, you first, when I'm sure everybody is safe and loved and free of suffering, then I will go free. And that was the Bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. The Dharma is endless. I vow to understand it all. And then I forget what the third and fourth, but the fourth one was, the Sangha is my home. The Sangha meaning satsang, the ashram, is my home, and that's where I'll stay, that's where I'll be, that's what I support. But when they go free, when people first go free, there's a tendency to not participate at all anymore in the world, because they see the world is empty. It's only thoughts, it's only made out of thoughts. But after 10 or 15 years, I started coming back into the world because I recognized that not a lot of people go free. So what do you do in the meantime? Help them, especially help the animals, because they have no choice. They have no right. They have no decision process whatsoever. And they have to be helped. And there's a lot of power in that. I think in lots of ways the ideal of the saint is more powerful than that of the yoni. Because Robert used to say about the yoni, he's good for nothing. There's absolutely no good he is in the world. He can't be used in any way. The transcripts of his was named the good for nothing man. You remember that one? Where his brother calls and brother says, Robert, I've just opened my fifth hardware store, and are you still doing nothing? And he said, well, I have this going on, the brother said, and I'm doing this and I'm doing this and I'm doing this. And Robert said, no, I'm not doing anything. And then Robert asked him, are you happy? And his brother started then talking to him about, well, his wife and he are breaking up. the kids are on drugs, one is going to prison, et cetera, et cetera. And he was abysmally unhappy. And Robert was happy. But that was his ideal, you know, to just be away and out of the world. He didn't have to worry about anybody else. Now, Robert, in the real world, was very caring of people that came to him. If he, and one time he saw somebody without any shoes and he gave him his shoes off his feet. I think I was there. I'm not sure. But he didn't go out of his way. He didn't fight causes. He didn't seek the liberation of all cats. He didn't, if a cat came to him, he might give him food for that day, but he wouldn't take the cat in. This way that I, what we're doing now, I think has much more power than what Robert did. Because all of you can feel that in you, the same desire to do that. The ones that are here, most people won't come here. Of course, most people never went to Robert either. It's even more rare for somebody to go to the Yoni without some kind of bhakti like this associated with it.
So with your students, it's a bit different because all of us have this really deep passion and need to give. So the people that awaken and you look at Rajiv, like, he's got that same deep,
yes, he does,
burning passion.
Yes.
So, and my question is, isn't for us, won't it be a lot different? Because we're
Yes, it will be.
We're like that independently. When we're not we're like that with each other.
Uh-huh. You don't need me then.
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. Shit. I just thought I was getting somewhere. Oh,
you can't go. That's another story. That's not, you know, you can't go.
I don't want to go.
So, but the thing is, like, when we're not with you, our community is functioning because of you, but because also what burns inside of all of us.
Exactly. Exactly. And it can be very powerful. This is only our second meeting. Yogananda's chants are very sweet, and they're in English. And this is one of the most beautiful. This is a purely devotional bhakti chant about the guru. Or whoever you're in love with at the moment.
I will sing thy name, I will drink thy name, and let all the world live by thee. I will sing thy name, I will drink thy name, and let all the world live by thee. I will sing thy name, I will drink thy name, and let all the world live by thee. I will sing thy name.
Get all drunk with thy name.
I will sing thy name.